Morning, kid.
Morning, Jimmy.
Now that's an attractive looking couple.
Yeah.
They have a kid? You won't be able to look directly at it. What about you? Max, you got any prospects?
Me? No.
Well, you should. You're a good looking guy. You got a good job. That kid's got nothing on you.
He's got his own driver.
What? You got somewhere you want to go?
I don't know. Maybe it's about time I figure out my own thing, you know?
You're a cobbler. That's your thing.
That's my father's thing.
And his father's before that. You should be proud.
Well, I gotta get back to work.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, as always, in these explorations and expeditions into the cinematic universe of one Adam Sandler, my co-curator, and your other host, Mr. Sejan Serowik. Sejan?
Thank you so much, Devin. And yes, tonight we are going down, yet again, down the tunnel of magical realism with Mr. Sandler, as we explore his classically flawed film, is, I think, the best way, the kindest way that I could put it from the gathered information on this film. Although we'll find that it does have its fans today, I think. Despite struggling to find them when it was released, it has found at least one here today.
From the mouths of babes to the ears of God. And I think what I need to say to start this off is, I know that season 4 is for the fans, but it really just kind of feels like our season 8 of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Have we done any movies not set in New York?
I don't know, man. We'd actually have to go back at Bedtime Stories.
Bedtime
New
Stories
York, right?
Is not set in New York. And that's the only one. That's the one that breaks it. But then, if we're also talking about it, a lot of parental issues in all of these family, like, for the fans episodes. Like, stuff where family...
Yeah, what's wrong with you guys? You guys get some real... You guys out there, you're really latching on to some problematic shit. What's going on?
No. What I am going to say is, it is season 4. It is for the fans. This is the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And we are here today to decide if The Cobbler, released in 2015, March 13th, 2015, is one of the shining stars in the universe that would be a shared cinematic universe of the films of Adam Sandler. And I made jokes, but this one is for the fans. This is another one of those movies that ever since we started doing this podcast, people have been coming out of the woodwork, finding us on Twitter or sending us direct messages via Gmail, asking us films to do. And The Cobbler was one of them.
Yeah.
And
I mean, even it's been one of those ones that's been kind of like riding. We've been keeping it kind of right behind us for the last like 2 years. Right. I feel like The Cobbler has come up every season. We've tried to figure out if we can fit it in because of the idea that people have just always asked about it. And we've been curious about looking at it as well. Because I don't know about you, but I saw this once when it first came out, right? Like a long time ago. It was at a time where basically Redbox had just kind of hit, and like we were just watching whatever we could get our hands on, even if we weren't like taking it in. And so I saw too many movies that way, so I didn't retain much from this film. So watching it for this today was definitely a refresher. But that's about the extent of my experience with The Cobbler up to this point.
On my end of the scale, this is the first time that I ever saw The Cobbler. Thank Tubi, right? I would just like to pause and say hooray for Tubi, because if it weren't for Tubi, I don't know where else I would have watched this film. This has always felt like a perennial Netflix film to me. And the reason for that is because The Cobbler comes out in 2015, right on the heels of the announcement of the big Netflix deal. And then one of the films that they got, since this was very, very small theatrical release, and then primarily just released to video on demand services, this was one of those films that dropped on Netflix, and it was kind of hard not to conflagrate it with the fact that Adam had just made this huge deal with Netflix to release all of these original films through the service.
When did streaming for Netflix start? Do you have that year off the top of your head?
I mean, I was streaming on Netflix in 2008.
Yeah. So the cobbler, it rests in this weird place for me, and I think this kind of comes hand in hand with the whole Adam Sandler deal and everything, where it feels like they had had a few originals up to that point, right? Like they had their House of Cards, they had their Orange is the New Black and all that, right? So they were already in the business. Netflix was already in the business of making their own content, and then teaming up with somebody kind of elevated it to that level of like shit's about to get real, right? Because before that, it was like we're working with these artists for these individual shows, but this was kind of the first time that we had heard about them being like this guy's going to stick around for a while, and the person they chose was Adam Sandler, and I think they, for good or for ill, kind of tied themselves to some of what the cobbler's release, because you're right. I do remember it being like one of the first ones that was available immediately after that deal was announced, but it wasn't a Netflix produced one. It was just that, like you said, it was the small indie film that had not really gone anywhere otherwise. So Netflix was able to snatch it up really easy and be like, see, we've even got the latest Adam Sandler movie to go along with our deal. Whether or not this movie had been well received didn't seem to be an issue to Netflix. And honestly, to this day, kind of telling that Netflix doesn't ever seem to really care about that.
Yeah, it is. It's a very strange film, but I will. It is one of those films that always felt like this was a Netflix original, and I was surprised to find out that it wasn't when we started doing the show and that Ridiculous 6 was the first official film to come out of that partnership. And then also, when I went to Netflix, where I've always been recommended The Cobbler, right? Especially as somebody who does an Adam Sandler podcast, constantly the recommendations would be like Big Daddy, Hubie Halloween, The Cobbler, and it's just like, okay, eventually I'm gonna watch The Cobbler, just calm down. And when it finally came time for me to watch The Cobbler, Netflix was like, yeah, no, you had your chance. Good luck finding it.
Like a
And
jilted lover. Oh
luckily
man.
on the Say Report, we had to use Tubi, I believe, for Surf's Up, to do the very special episode on Surf's Up. So it was one of those things in my like searching all of the streaming services for this film available, then I'm like, well, I guess I'll check Tubi too before I end up like spending money or trying to track down a DVD of this. And lo and behold, there it was on Tubi. And like, I really enjoy Tubi as a streaming service. It's not the last time we're going to hear about it if the streaming like television networks that they have as part of the Tubi infrastructure is any indication. Of course, that could go away by the time we get there, but that's really more season five stuff. Right now we are in season four. It is the season for the fans, and I have to say, I don't think like Seijin certainly queued this up for me as the guy who's like, I forgot about this movie. I loved this film. I absolutely loved The Cobbler. And I don't know why, and as much as this episode is going to be an exploration of how, if at all, does this film fit in with the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, it's also kind of going to be me trying to explore what about the Cobbler, like, directly connected to Devin Dekker, and why I enjoyed this film just as much as I did. But I'm right now, I'm willing to write Cobbler fan fiction. That's where my mind is at after this movie.
So I will say that my big takeaway after rewatching this film is I just feel like there's a lot of it's just like not fun to watch for like 30 minutes, and then it becomes this really like goofy magical heist almost type film, like with the ways in which it like it starts, it almost feels like a Guy Ritchie film, like with like some Disney magic involved or some shit, like it gets really wild for about 40 minutes, and then it wraps up again, and then there's a 10 minute extra scene that once again bogs it down, like the beginning of the movie. It's weird because it just feels like two different films to me, and like 40 minutes of it I half-heartedly enjoy, because who doesn't love a good heist, especially when there's actual magic involved. I mean, color me now, you see me, right? But like this idea being that like it turns into this, where this whole thing where he's going to steal the watches and he's going to use this new superpower that he's developed, like I was suddenly, my interest was piqued, but never quite grabbed, even in those moments when I was actually like in it. So like it's I really want to be there with you. I will say that. I don't think anything in this movie is actively working against it, other than the fact that it doesn't, I can't tell what this movie's trying to do at any point. Like, it doesn't have like a full-on like spine to it. No matter how much morality finger wagging it wants to do, like it does these weird moments where like it looks at the camera basically and tells you a thing about like your ethics that you should like take in, and that's great and all, but it never feels like that's the point of these other scenes. It's really weird.
Yeah, as much as this feels like an ancient Brooklyn folktale or an ancient Lower East Side folktale, like the nicest thing about folktales and folklore is that there's usually some message attached to it. And honestly, I don't know what the message would be. I have a semi-idea connected, and honestly, that could be the entire crux of why this film works for me. But we'll explore that once we've talked about the film a little bit more. So you know how we felt about the movie upon this watch. I'm just gonna quick like bullet point what exactly it is that we're doing here, who we are, like why you should be listening to us, just in case this is your first visit to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. Welcome. You picked a weird time to come in because this season is all about the fan service. But the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, it is inspired by Seijin and I. We do another podcast called The Say Report, and that is a podcast that is about everything. No topic is off limits at The Say Report. And, you know, that's fun. It's fun to do like this broad topic show where we can kind of talk about whatever we feel like. But one of the topics we stumbled upon right around the release of Hubie Halloween was Adam Sandler and whether or not these films exist in some sort of shared cinematic universe. And after Seijin and I mentioned that on an episode of the show, friends, family, relations, this one stranger at the bus station, they wouldn't stop telling us, well, if you have such strong opinions, why don't you put your money where your mouth is? So we kind of spun off from the Say Report to do the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. So it's a hyper-focused topic, literally the films of one actor. So it's a bit of a tonal shift for us in what we're doing. And right now, you're in our 25th episode, and I'm kind of happy that we've been able to get through 25 episodes focusing on Adam Sandler films. You see a lot of the other, like, well, sorry, specifically with The Cobbler, I found a lot of other podcasts that were like, we're going to look into the films of Adam Sandler and take it like hyper seriously. And like, we know that he's a comedian, but we want to really look at these movies and break them down. And for one of these podcasts, I don't remember the name of it, and I feel bad about that. But their first episode was The Cobbler, and then within 2 episodes, they're like, we're never doing another episode of this show. And I'm just like, oh, wow. Okay. So they did The Cobbler, they did Going Overboard, and then they did Deuce Bigalow Male Gigolo. Those were the three that I found. I don't have the name. I will have the name as a Christmas gift for our December episode because I'm talking about them. But it was just one of those moments where it kind of put everything that we've done so far into perspective. And it made me like weirdly happy that, I mean, we have definitely come up against some movies, see Bedtime Stories, that have just sucked the life out of us and our desire to continue this like fool's errand that we have set out upon. And perhaps it's because we're following up something like Bedtime Stories, which was just such a heavy miss for the two of us, that like I was hyper receptive to enjoy a film. But that's really more analysis if like someone decides to do a show about this show, right? Because the numbers are out there, and I bet you can, I tangentially can think of some connections where that might be the case, but that's for somebody else to do. Right now, we're here to discuss The Cobbler and whether or not, based upon the tenets that we have set forward for admission into our shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films, does The Cobbler fit? And I gotta tell you, I'm just super happy that I enjoyed this film as much as I did, especially because, as Siege mentioned, it does start out kind of sad, right? It's a little bit slow. You gotta see where Max Simkin's character is and why he would be looking for the escape that his magical power offers him. And the way that they do that is to just front end this movie with a bunch of really sad and depressing shit.
Well, I mean, and then the sad and depressing stuff, and the majority of what you're talking about happens to characters that we never then see again. Because the opening 10 minutes of this movie, they shoehorn in this historical kind of I don't know what that moment is supposed to be. I specifically don't know what that moment is supposed to be because you think to yourself, oh well, this must be the event that kicks off the magic, right? Like the thing that like start that the thing that really kind of sets the tone. It's the pissing into the I don't know why this is my example, but
That's fine.
pissing into the same wishing fountain in the change-up, right? Where it's that thing that sets off the whole spell.
I
But
can't
then
wait
you
till we
learn.
get to Borrowed and I can totally explain to you why you're thinking of the change-up. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But there's this whole idea of that must be where this whole thing starts. But then later we're given a completely different story about how the whole thing started. So I'm left wondering why we needed that scene in the first 10 minutes. And that's the kind of stuff that bogs down the kind of emotional movie they're trying to tell versus the silly heist film that you get to later, where there's none of we've already gotten all the backstory we need from the sad part. So that part works a little bit better, but I don't know if it's worth the slog I had to do with this nonsense to get there. You know what I mean?
It's really strange because that's sort of this place setting, and then you understand, and it kind of functions really well in terms of this is that same story told again and again throughout time. It's sort of like Soul Calibur, but with a cobbler's stitcher machine, and that's something
Yeah.
that I have no problem saying. But
Oh God. Just
I also really want to know how things worked out with that whole story beginning in 1903, because
Well, it's weird because it's not the beginning. It's this whole thing where his family has had this superpower for years to in order to create shoes that he could step into and then literally walk in somebody else's shoes, right? Like it's a pretty ham-fisted metaphor, but there you go, right? It's a fable in that way. So I'm willing to forgive that nature of it, but that is how we're brought into this story, and we're introduced to this whole event, this whole thing happening, and it's not even the beginning of the magic, and we're not clarified on what the magic is. It doesn't provide anything for us. It really doesn't.
No, it weirdly ties into the end of the film, and we are so far away from talking about the end of the film that we should probably move on to another topic. And the other topic that I want to work into, one of the reasons why I was so hesitant to watch this movie is, unfortunately, I feel like everybody checked out about 30 minutes into this film. I will
Yes.
be the first person to admit that 2 minutes in, the note I wrote down is, this is a fucking Adam Sandler movie, because we haven't seen him yet, and we're in 1903, Lower East Side of New York City, and it does not feel like Adam Sandler is going to mesh with anything that is going on. But eventually, and I certainly hope that once I read the synopsis and everything, there's some more understanding of why this happens. He uses the shoes to give his mother, who is suffering from dementia or Alzheimer, some sort of memory affecting illness, one last date with his absentee father, because his father has left his family, which is a big story point that decides to only come up when it deems itself important. Is that a wrong read, CJ? It seems like you're stifling
No,
there.
I am no, I'm right there with you, man. We're given this emotional stuff, but then never given any time to deal with it. And while at the same time, shit happens that has nothing to do with the emotional stuff. So I'm like, I don't know what to care about and what not to care about. And for you, it seems like what you decided to do was just love it all. For me, I was like, I care about none of this.
What I love, what I think one of the first reasons why this film is just completely in my wheelhouse, is the folkloric nature of this movie. It
Sure,
and I
yeah.
love that. That's what I was raised on. When I was like traveling and I needed like books, I would always go into local bookstops and try to find like local folklore books so that I could better understand where I was and the stories about it. Steve Gammell's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. As much fun as the stories are, the appendices in those books are like actual history lessons on how the stories like came to be and how they were spread and how they've changed as they were spread. So this just feels like a modern day folklore, and I instantly connected with that. And I know that for a fact. But that whole idea that he works on a pair of his father's shoes, puts them on, and gives his mother this like beautiful date night that like makes her very happy. And then, you know, she passes away in her sleep after that night. Like, that's all anyone would ever talk about. And then through, I don't know if it's like the guise of memory or just like snark and sarcasm, like being definitely the language of the day in 2015 when we talked about movies, let alone Adam Sandler films, because at this point we've had like the Grown Ups films. The whole idea that all Adam Sandler does is take his friends on vacation to do movies. Like, people are not loving Adam Sandler the way they are in 2022 is something that I will definitely ascribe to 2015 cinema. Especially like Pixels. I was like, that was a struggle to find anybody to go see Pixels with me. And then the person who eventually agreed to go see it the first time was like, yeah, I kind of want to make fun of it, so I want to go see it. And I'm like, oh, cool. This will be fun for me. So that's it. But then that whole idea that, you know, he puts on shoes and becomes this other person, like what it eventually degraded down to through the game of telephone was, oh yeah, Adam Sandler fucks his mom in that movie.
I was gonna look. Okay. So here's the thing. As I said earlier, I'd only seen it when it first kind of hit the scene back in the day. We had rented it one night, like literally, I think, like in a drunken haze from like a Shaw's like Red Box or something. So that's like my first experience with it, and then watching it this week. And the only thing I remembered from before, forgot all of this shit. With the whole like with the watches and him becoming like six different people in like 10 minutes and that sort of thing, just like completely left my brain. What I did remember was this whole super uncomfortable scene where you're just like, oh no, oh why would you, oh no, like why not like get someone else in on the bit and like what,
you know, honestly my thought
at this
was
moment while watching the movie, why not get Jimmy?
yeah
So like there's this whole fucking thing about just like what the fuck is going to happen in this scene, and that's what you walk away from that scene with. It's not this like sweet like enlightening scene about like about him caring for his mother. It becomes this whole thing where like he shows up to go on a date with his mother, and then peel back, like, eventually seeing the scene and nothing happens. So, like, whew, okay, sigh of relief there that I don't have to deal with that mental thing for the rest of my life. But then you peel back the idea of, like, he kind of just, like, gaslighted his mom's dementia. And there's a lot of weird politics around that that I can't even begin to fathom, right? Like it's so fucking weird that he does this thing that, like, to his mother in so many ways. So all of that is to say, I understand why it got to that point in that game of telephone. And to be honest, that feeling that you get when you hear that is not far off from the feeling you have when you're watching it, as far as I'm concerned. So like, as much as it is a complete over-exaggeration of the scene, it's not such an over-exaggeration that I would call it unkind.
Yeah. I mean, I watched it and my heart was warmed. I thought like this act of kindness, especially because everything else we've seen him do with this power up to that point has kind of been hyper fucking selfish.
I think that's purposeful, right? Yeah. Like he's learning that he needs to use this power for good, like as any good superhero origin story will tell you, right?
Yeah. So it's, and
don't
I really
just fight Buzzsaw. You got to also save your uncle, right? Like, yeah.
I don't know. It's just. Yeah, it really worked for me, and I'm just like, man, it kind of stinks that like this is the aura that surrounds this film, is that it's the film where Adam Sandler uses magic to fuck his mom. I'm like, there's something very Oedipal about all that. And oh my God, especially when like the movie is starting and it's a Voltage Pictures film. And I'm just like, is this going to turn into like a straight horror movie at some point? Like what is happening? Cause
there is a level at which this is a horror movie.
Yeah.
Like we could talk about that more too, after we get into some of the more like the juicier details, yeah. But like there is shit that happens in this movie that if you put the right music behind it, it is actually horrific.
Yeah. It'd
be so much. I got caught in my throat.
But watching it and just seeing it, like, I just kind of was, I was there for everything that was happening because there was, like, this earnesty behind all of his actions and everything that was on screen. Everybody was committed to it, and that kind of worked. But you're right. If I ever pause to stop and think about outside of the movie, as we're doing right, this is the first time that I'm ever thinking of the cobbler outside of the cobbler. Yeah, no, it's, It could be a terrifying little film, couldn't it? I mean, also on the heels of something like Bedtime Stories, where like I was given was opportunity to think about how fucked up everything that was happening in that film actually was. It was nice to have this film that kept me so engaged with the world it wanted me to be a part of that I never once paused and stopped to like consider the deeper ramifications. I mean, that's not true. Okay. There's definitely a scene I think we're going to talk about when we get to Blue, if I had to call what your Blue is. But we'll get there. So before we go any further, now that we've shared all these thoughts and experiences with it, do you have any facts and figures on this film, Cedrin?
Yeah, so I've got some. We're running into that issue where, once again, IMDb and Box Office Mojo don't seem to want to talk about certain films, so they, like, bury certain stuff about them. Well, so I don't know what the full budget was on this movie, but I can tell you that it didn't make a stellar amount. Only made $6.5 million when all was said and done. That is a worldwide number. There's not even a domestic number here for it. And also, there's this weird back and forth about when it came out, but it came out, by all accounts, February of 2015. That is the earliest release date, despite the fact that it seems to be labeled a 2014 movie in all of these different places. And the only reason that that's important is because the guy that directed this film, Tom McCarthy, do you know what else he did in 2015?
No, I do not.
He won an Oscar for Spotlight, Dev.
Oh, damn!
Yeah, so the guy that released The Cobbler in February of 2015 would then go on to later that year release Spotlight, that he also wrote and directed, and he won an Oscar for that year. So he has two movies, Tom McCarthy this year, and this is clearly not his favorite.
I mean, I have some Tom McCarthy stuff to share once we get a little deeper into the film, but I mean, I knew that he was on Spotlight, but yeah, that is insane that both of these are 2015. What I did, because I also ran into, I finally got to experience it personally, because after literally coming against about nothing but walls about people regarding this film, like, I didn't like that movie. I can't believe you guys are actually going to do The Cobbler for this, which is like, I don't understand that, right? This is not a film that, like, we just snuck into the For the Fans. I have emails. I have conversations with people being like, when are you guys going to do The Cobbler? I'm really interested to see your take on that film.
I mean, it comes out in February of 2015. It is in the pit of, like, I mean, you said it yourself earlier, that anti-Sandler sentiment being running rampant, right? Like it's cool at this point to shit on Adam Sandler. And I'm not even making a judgment on that. I mean, I kind of am if you read the tone of my voice, but like, it is a fact. There was a point in this man's career in which it becomes like he becomes the butt of the joke, so much to the point where he knows it. He makes fun of it himself and things like Funny People and stuff, and that goes on for a long time in his career, and some might say is still going on in a lot of ways. So like, there is a certain type of person that is going to view this kind of film in that light, all in that window of they just don't like Adam Sandler, which is like, you know, like that's an opinion to have, but you can't be surprised that there are people out there that feel that way. We talk about that all the time.
No, I understand it, but it's just so weird because I feel like This is officially 2 years of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. It's been 2 years since we released that first, like, trailer and our, like, modus operandi, our mission statement as to what we wanted to accomplish with this film. So, like, happy 2 year anniversary, Seijin. Like, round of applause.
Yeah.
But in those 2 years, I mean, we got people who asked us to do The Cobbler, and then as soon as we do it, I feel like from the other side of the woodwork was everybody coming out being like, that's a death sentence. How are you going to come back from that? And it's been very interesting, especially as someone who enjoyed the film. So when I went to IMDb to try to see how much money it made in the United States and saw that every country was listed but the US of A, I was like, well, that's interesting. But then I decided, and I know that Wikipedia is Wikipedia, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, but I did look at the Wikipedia article on The Cobbler, and that's where I found out apparently this film, according to Wikipedia, only had a $10 million budget. So the fact that it only came in at $6.5 million globally earned, like, this movie is a failure by almost every metric that you could use to judge it.
Yeah, because then now's a good time in that sentiment to point out its ratings, and the best thing that we've got for that is Rotten Tomatoes. That's where we're getting this info. But with 72 critic reviews, it only holds a 10% on the critic rating. And then the audience rating is a little bit better. It's at 36%, but that's with over 5,000 ratings. So that's a pretty hefty one, and 36% out of over 5,000 ratings give this one a watchable review. That being said, like, you go and scroll through some of the written reviews, and I can't tell you how many of the good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes start out with Adam Sandler tries to step up his game, or like Adam Sandler tries to make one for the adults, right? Like, they all start with that caveat, and then the opinion always seems to be the same. He falls back into the same shtick, but this time it's watchable. And it's really weird because you kind of hinted at this earlier. This doesn't feel like Adam Sandler's shtick at any real point for me. Like, even in the goofier moments later in the film, it doesn't ever feel like Adam Sandler goof.
Well, the weird thing is they talk about the impressionism of this film in the Wikipedia article of it.
Yeah.
Like, they talk about, this is Adam Sandler after a string of disappointments and mockery from critics trying to tie his horse to an established director to try to raise his, like, cachet in Hollywood. Like, that's one thing that a critic said. It didn't credit it to anybody. Like, I'm sure the footnote would give it to you if you go to the Wikipedia article. But then it also celebrates the film's, like, use of impressions. And it's like, but that doesn't really say anything about Adam Sandler. That's like credit to Method Man and the plethora of actors who play Max Simkin while he's wearing their shoes. It's such a weird metric to sort of celebrate about this film. I definitely feel that Adam Sandler built a character for the role of Max Simkin. He didn't just come in and do the goofy voice, right? In fact, I don't think he ever does the goofy voice in this movie, right? Which would probably make my mother very happy, as long as I'm not watching it with her in my father's shoes.
I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm sitting here with the Roger Ebert .com. I would need to double check who it is that wrote this, though, because Brian Tallarico is the one that wrote it. It's a half-star review for this movie on RogerEbert.com. There's some really, really good stuff throughout it, but I think his best point is towards the end where he goes, we don't learn anything about the people that Max becomes. In fact, the film is almost defiant in its judgment of books by their covers. He becomes genetically blessed and a girl hits on him. He becomes his dad and his mom treats him as if he's her lost partner. So he just becomes these people. The Cobbler suggests that walking a mile in someone else's shoes will make you look like that person, but not actually experience anything else about them. So, like, it's this whole thing where it's trying to tell this morality story, as we kind of said earlier, where it's like it wants you to learn this whole idea about becoming this other person is going to teach you this thing, and it's going to teach you something and make you a better person. But then he becomes other people, and he never does anything. Like, he never truly becomes those other people, right? Like he does, he dresses differently, he behaves differently, he just kind of just is there for like a moment. He never learns anything by becoming anyone else.
Well,
You know, the act of becoming his father for his mother is maybe the closest where he kind of really starts to learn that he needs to maybe stop being so selfish. But that's that is 40 minutes into the movie, if that. And then like there's still another hour left, and he doesn't seem to like learn much beyond that.
yeah, it's I mean, specifically, like a really big moment of that is when he is pretending to be Leon and to like go to the job, and he has to deal with Patrick the Rat Prick, which that's
Right.
just so clever. I just have to give credit to Tom McCarthy for that. I can see why he won an Oscar this same year.
Also, the guy that wrote The Station Agent and one of my favorites, the early like early Disney Plus release, Timmy Failure. Just want to point out those are some other movies that you
Excellent.
might know him from.
Well, I again, we'll get there because spoilers. He's probably my new is what I'm gonna say.
Ha.
I'm taking that from you right now. But it's you threw me off with Timmy Failure. I apologize, Agent.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
I love that movie and
You're a big
wanted to get
fan.
its
I know.
recognition.
But that whole sequence, like, it would be something if he had to act like. That false machismo, that like macho toxic masculinity that character just oozes, but instead he's basically just Max in this situation. So does he really learn anything from walking that mile in this dude's shoes?
Right. Yeah, it's really unfortunate because they bring out this giant ass watermelon of a point, right? With the whole walk a mile in their shoes stuff, and you're just like, well, that's so obvious. Like he could never miss. And then Gallagher takes the hammer and somehow swings off stage. And it's like, what the fuck? Like, well, what did we just witness? Like they set themselves up so easily, and they still seem to stumble. And it's just like, that can't abide.
Honestly, it's like Gallagher hits the watermelon and the hammer explodes. And there's nothing funny about a hammer exploding. That's just dangerous. All right. So, are any other facts, figures, or things that you want to share? Because it's feeling like time for me to tell people a brief overview of what this film
What
is.
really happens in this movie? No, let's do it. Let's do it.
Our story begins long ago when a vagrant knocked at the door of Simpkin's expert cobbler repair on the coldest winter night. The elder Simpkin provided shelter and food when no one else would, and even went the extra mile in repairing the vagrant's shoes. The next morning, the vagrant, who some believe to have been Eliyahu Hanavi in disguise, was gone, and in his place all he left was a new stitcher for Simpkin. Now in the modern day, his great-great-great-grandson, Max Simpkin, continues the family's long tradition of cobblery in the very same storefront as his forebears, now christened Simpkin's Shoe Repair. Unfortunately, while his ancestors saw the nobility in the profession, Max feels trapped by it, not only by the mundanity of the work, but also because his father abandoned it to him. Luckily, all of that is about to change. One day, on a rush job for Leon Ludlow, a customer whose entire demeanor could only be described as playfully threatening, Max's automatic stitcher breaks. With a repairman unable to come until tomorrow, and fearing what might happen if the shoes aren't done for 6 p.m., he is left with no choice but to use the old manual stitcher his father left in the basement. When Leon fails to show, Max notices they have the same shoe size, 10 and a half, and tries them on. To his surprise, once he's wearing both shoes, his face and body change to match those of Leon, allowing him to walk a mile in another man's shoes. Immediately trying on another pair of 10 and a halves, but failing to achieve the same result, Max realizes only shoes that have been stitched on the manual stitcher are imbued with the power of transformation. Armed with this new ability, Max begins stepping outside of his comfort zone, experiencing different cultures, enjoying fancy dinners, and finally seeing what it is like to be the attractive man at the bar. He even decides to share his bounty by allowing his mother to have one last date night with her absentee fa with his absentee father, which ultimately allows her to pass peacefully and happily in her sleep. After Leon makes a snide remark about his mother's passing, Max decides to use the power of the Stitcher to steal his watch collection and sell it off to purchase a nice headstone for his mother, which would have gone fine if Leon hadn't come home early and found Max there in Leon face. Max is then forced to impersonate Leon to pick up payment for a job in the amount of $50,000 from developer Ellen Greenewalt. Upon returning to Leon's apartment, Leon has slipped his bonds and in a brief altercation winds up dead when Max stabs his windpipe with a stiletto heel. Now an orphan who has learned that with great shoes comes great responsibility, Max decides it is time to begin using his superpowers for good and fights back to save the Lower East Side from Greenewalt's nefarious development scheme.
All right. I have a question.
Yes, please.
What happened to Leon's body?
Oh, Jimmy took care of it, because barbers have always been very good friends to cobblers. Don't worry about it.
You also didn't talk about the last... you got through the best... Okay, so you got up to the how it turns into this weird like heist film about him stealing the watches, resolved the heist film, but you forget that there's like 20 minutes after that where they still go back to all the family stuff.
Yeah, but that's because I kind of wanted to talk about it more. And I don't know, like, these feel like, all right, writing a synopsis for an Adam Sandler film has always been a challenge, right? It's something that I relish to do.
Make it seem easy. I just want you to know that.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. But it is something that, like, but when I'm sitting there with just a blank page in front of me, and it has to be like, some of these films are like wicked episodic. Some of them are just like vignettes, and it's like, well, what vignettes do I borrow? Some of them have a framing device that does not connect at all with the rest of the film, but like you still feel a bit compelled to mention it because it did sort of set the stage for everything that happened. And it's always pick and choose, and I always try to go with the broadest possible strokes so that you would understand, like, that these are the things that happen in the movie. In The Cobbler, Max is able to become other people. He makes his mom so happy she dies. Then he pretends to be a terrible customer to steal his watches, ends up killing him, but then somehow saves the day, right?
Yeah, no. And the poster sells it as he's saving the neighborhood one soul at a time. S-O-L-E, get it? Because they're always, always happy to make that joke throughout this entire movie. But it even sells itself as that's the whole story, right? But
yeah.
That's not the whole story of this movie, man. There's this whole thing with his dad that is, like, hugely important in the beginning and the end of this film that seems to just not be in throughout the rest of it.
Yeah, that is... And it's hugely important because, like, that's the only reason he's not happy with what he's doing is because he didn't choose it. His father didn't even choose it. It's not like he grew up in his father's shadow telling him, this one day will be a shop, son. It's more the fact that his father left and honestly, all he had to provide for himself and his mother was his father's shop. And the fact that he was able to provide for himself and his mother at a shop that charges like $16 for shoe repair that's the most he ever charges somebody who comes in there blows me away.
So his dad's an asshole, right? Like by the end of this movie, his dad is just an awful person.
I mean, there is this last minute, like he's already been drowning cats the entire film, but then there's this last minute like moment where Jimmy, who at this time we only know as the neighbor to the cobbler shop, right?
We should clarify right now that Dustin Hoffman does not play a cat murderer in this movie. That was a turn of phrase.
Yes, no, because save the cat moment is sort of the moment where I don't even know how to use it. Seijin is much better at it than me, but I know that a save the cat moment kind of makes a person redeemable or good in the eyes of the audience, right? Am I using that correctly?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I actually just saw a really crazy ass example of it. I watched the new I was gonna say Henry Selick, but it's not. It is Henry Selick, isn't it? Wendell and Wilde, the new stop motion movie on Netflix. And in order to make you fall in love with the key, if you're not already in love with the Key and Peele portrayed Wendell and Wilde, there's this beautiful moment where they're trying to find something that they need to m murder in order to move the plot along, shall we say? But they look at their shared horse and they're thinking, oh yeah, this would be perfect. And then suddenly they realize, oh, but it's a living thing and we love it. And everything up to that point, you wouldn't understand that you wouldn't believe that that's the way that they go. But it was like this weird moment where I was like, that's a save the cat moment. They want us to know that they have a line at some point with all the other crazy shit we've seen these two do. They won't kill this one animal, and so that we're supposed to believe that they're good people then.
Right. And it's also
And
not
like,
like Dustin Hoffman, Abraham Simkin, is sitting there like actually doing it. It's all from the perspective of Max and this way that like his father left us. My father left us. My father just abandoned us. He didn't seem to care about his family, right? So it's all him telling these horror stories about his father as I metaphorically spoke. Drowning cats. And then Jimmy comes up to be like, the only reason that he left you is because he got in trouble with the wrong people, and the only way to spare you and your mother from suffering the consequences of his actions was for him to essentially fake his death and go into hiding. And it's like, that comes very, very late in this film for you to kind of be like, oh, I guess everything could be forgiven, right? He had noble reasons for doing it. But,
But
like,
then the
we.
rug is pulled out on that completely.
Yeah, that is.
Because the reveal at the end of this film that I cannot believe you have been avoiding up until this point is that Jimmy is his dad in just another pair of shoes.
In addition to being Steve Buscemi, so I mean, usually I would
Right.
ask, how did he get Steve Buscemi to be in this film? But the truth is, he didn't. He got Dustin Hoffman to wear a pair of magic shoes to resemble Steve Buscemi. Everybody says that there are 10 movies that Adam and Steven are in. I posit and argue and will go to the mattresses saying that there are only 9.
I would go so far as to say maybe he's not in any of them. Maybe we've been wrong this whole time, and he's just been taking the Steve Buscemi shoes around from set to set and just getting random people to play him.
Maybe there is no Steve Buscemi. Maybe it's always shoes. Always has
Steve
been.
Buscemi is just always shoes, just two shoes and a trench coat.
We love you, Steve Buscemi. We're just having fun with the conceit of this film. I want to make sure we say that, just in case, you know? I mean, he
Oh
was
my
in
God.
Fargo, and that'd be scary.
Yeah, right.
But yes, it is. Yeah, the reveal at the end that Jimmy has been his father in shoes. I mean, like, first of all.
Oh my God. The thing that gets me about it is not the it is the fact that we witness how important his father was to his mother, and his mother straight up dies, and we see Jimmy at that at sitting shiva with him. Like it is like a huge thing that like that is a huge scene in this movie where like and it's just the idea of how fucking cold of a human being does he need to be to not be losing his shit and breaking whatever weird contract with the devil he feels he's made that he has to be this person. I cannot believe that he goes to that funeral like that and does not reveal to him then and there what's going on. It's just mind-blowing to me.
The really crazy thing is that almost in a Usual Suspects style reviewing of the film, there are so many little hints that like reveal Steve Buscemi's real nature as the Dustin Hoffman
Kaiser
father of the
Soze? Oh,
character.
right.
Nope,
Yeah,
nope, nope.
yeah.
Maybe Verbal Kin isn't Kaiser Soze. It's just another pair of shoes. It's all shoes. Astronaut 2 always has been.
Oh, God.
You know what is just like anecdotal and completely not related to it? This is Say Report, Devin Decker speeding. Heidi ho speaking. Heidi ho, everybody. I wore the wrong shoes to work today.
Oh, no, you weren't the right Devin.
Like, luckily it was a Friday schedule on a Wednesday because of the holiday that's coming, the day that this releases.
The
So I didn't see
wrong
anybody.
Devin.
Wrong
The wrong.
Devin, wrong schedule. It was. I wore the wrong shoes. And
The
I'm
Wrong
just like,
Devin sounds like a Gene Wilder comedy from
I,
the
the Wrong
70s.
Devin sounds like something that we're eventually going to make if we have our druthers. But yeah, it's just like, but it's really like there are all these little hints, like the fact that Jimmy says, "Oh, did you give your mother those pears I sent you?" And then Max is like, "Yeah, why the fuck did you send my mom pears?" But then at the end of the movie, you're like, "Well, of course he did, because he knows that his wife loves pears, and it's sort of the only way that he can still show that he loves her." Even though it's so bananas. But then when he's like, "Yeah, my father taught me how to use this old manual stitcher when I was a boy," and there's like this flash of pride on Buscemi's face. It's
Here's the
so
thing.
good.
Here's the thing you really got to think about, right?
Yeah.
Is the shoes only work on another human being that is alive. We learn all of that through various moments in this movie. He becomes a zombie in this movie. He becomes a zombie for more than just a joke. At first, it's just a bit, and then it becomes plot significant that he can become one.
Oh, he becomes two zombies
Okay.
because Method Man's Leon character is killed by a stiletto heel and he's still walking around as him. And just in this, like, all credit to the makeup department, like the gradual paling of Method Man's skin as he becomes him, as he is clearly dead somewhere and decomposing, like, yeah,
But like,
it's.
so there's this whole thing, right? What were we talking about? We were talking about his. Oh, so there has to be a Jimmy, right? There has to be a Jimmy out there somewhere. At some point, wait, like, when did this facade start? Because there's also this implication that they've owned the shop next to each other for a long time. Was there a guy named Jimmy that was there next door that he made that his father made shoes for at one point, and he just became that guy? It seems like a really
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
where's the actual Jimmy?
He's on a beach somewhere. When he had to go into hiding, first of
Right.
all
We
this
are told
lore,
that, right? We are
yeah,
told that
we're
he's in like
told
the
that he is
Caribbean or
alive,
something.
he's in the Caribbean, and he's loving life.
But
Because.
so was that Jimmy around at first, and now he was replaced by his dad, or has that guy just always been gone, and his dad has just always had this double life of running these two stores?
No, that Jimmy goes away because in the same moment where we're told that Jimmy is in the Caribbean on a beach loving life, we are told that barbers have always been good friends to cobblers. So, like,
Right.
Abraham was the cobbler and the guardian of souls, right? I love that joke. I'm so sorry. And Jimmy was like his Alfred, his close confidant, right? So that's the thing that happens. So then when it comes time that Dustin Hoffman's Abraham needs to go into hiding, he decides, well, I'm going to hide in plain sight as Jimmy. But Jimmy, you have to leave the country. And Jimmy's like, I'm fine with that. I'm going to live in the beach. You're probably going to pay for everything. Sounds good. But
Well, right,
also.
because we also know that this power can definitely be used for personal gain, and it seems to have no like ethical consequences.
Maybe you have to eat two pickles? I mean, that is another thing that is just like tossed out at the end, that pickles preserve you
Oh,
while you're switching bodies.
but just like you were pointing out that you get all this evidence about Jimmy and how he might actually be his dad the whole time, right? Lo and behold, the pickles are there even all the way back in 1903. I actually noted as I was watching today. I was like, why are they having this super important meeting and all that's on the table is a lamp and a bowl of pickles? I didn't, and then like later in the movie, because I forgot that that was like the reveal, right? And then later in the movie, you find that out, and it's like, shit, that's been there since the beginning.
Yeah, pickles preserve you, much like an American pickle with Seth Rogen, who was in Funny
What?
People with Adam Sandler, Kevin Bacon.
I don't know what movie you're talking about. As far as HBO Max is concerned, that movie's does not going to exist
Oh,
anymore in a few
right.
months.
That's a good point. It exists now when we're recording it. Don't let David Zaslav change the history
You want to see a really
of
good
cinema.
Jewish folktale like told on film? Like, go watch American Pickle before it's
American
gone.
Pickle is very good. It was a very enjoyable film. I think this was a pretty good folk tale too, but again, that's me. But yeah, like they add all this lore at the end after the lore has pretty much been working for itself really well. Like even right down to, and it might not have aged hyper well from 2015 to 2022, but the fact that like he never changes genders. is a really interesting little wrinkle. And the way that they describe that is like the fact that he is wearing a trans woman's shoes. Like, that's how they're 10 and a half. But then, like, yeah. Also, what is considered wearing shoes? Could he wear like a pair of 11s, or do they have to fit tightly to your feet?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. At what point is a size too big? And then how silly is a shoe, right? Like if somebody brings in a pair of old slippers that are like shaped like Mickey Mouse, if he puts those on, is he going to become grandpa?
Only if they've gone on the Stitcher. It's nuts. It honestly is just insane. Like, cause my other question is, who is the owner of a pair of shoes? Right? Like, how much time do you have in shoes for them to be considered your shoes?
So this is where I think the movie kind of does a disservice to the whole folklore nature of it, right? It tells you so much information and so much backstory on him, and all, it gives you too much information where you start to ask these questions. Whereas like a good fairy tale or a good folklore, like you're only given just some baseline information about some of the weirder stuff so that you don't think about it too hard. It's why animals can talk. It's why like men can do mighty feats that they can't in real life, because it's not about that, right? It's about the moral. It's about the point. This movie wants to be this folkloric nature of a film, right? But then it gives you too many details to ground it in reality, so you start asking all these questions about how does this work. You shouldn't have to ask those questions if it's a truly good like folktale of a story. I mean, like, think about the ways in which we talked about Uncut Gems, right? And about how that was very much like this like morality play of Jewishness just on display yet again, right? There's this whole idea of, in that movie, we talked very specifically about how kind of over the top some things get towards the end, but about how it earned it because of the ways in which it built to it and it explained it, and it never gave you too much stuff to question that, right? This movie does the complete opposite. It trips over its own kind of detail work because it wants you to believe so badly that this is New York, the real world, but also believe in magic. And it's like, pick one.
Yeah, and yet I still found myself just thrilling in it. Even like on the second watch, I thought it was all going to fall apart when I did my watch taking notes about the film. And I still just found myself smiling, even in the moments where I'm like, well, how did that work? What about this? What about that? And I'm just like, you know what though? At the end of the day, I really enjoy what they set out to do with this film.
There is some really good work being done on this film in all levels. And I will like even say, like, to even some of the cinematography and film work, one of my favorite moments in this is when he first puts on his father's shoes. Or when it's the moment when Jimmy takes off. It's both, but it's the moment when Jimmy takes off the shoes to reveal that he's his father, and they have to do this switch to Dustin Hoffman from Steve Buscemi. And the way that they do that is they focus on Sandler, but in the mirror next to him, you can see Buscemi just out of like focus, like he's just kind of fuzzy. And the moment that he takes the shoe off, you can see that there's this like effect, this like slide of like a star wipe effect or something like that like he turns into his father. But because it's out of focus, it doesn't look that bad. And by the time they go back and suddenly reveal that it's Dustin Hoffman, like, it's a cool moment. It is a very cool moment. And then the other moment I was thinking of is when he first becomes his dad and he puts down the shoes, puts them on, looks up, looks in the mirror, and suddenly it's Dustin Hoffman, and the first words out of his mouth are, oh, hey, Pop. And of course, it's Dustin Hoffman, so that line is delivered perfectly, right? Like, it's beautiful, like, that whole moment. So there is good stuff going on throughout this entire movie. Like, you already mentioned earlier, like, anybody having to pretending to be him as they act as this other person as well, like, that stuff is just magical. So, like, that all worked for me. The problem is that this movie is just not as good as some of the parts, you know?
Yeah. I mean, also, while we're talking about, like, just, like, tricks of the camera, the tracking shots of him sitting in that, like, iconic trying on shoes chair from, like, a shoe store, and it going up the body, and that first time it goes up, and it's Method Man, and then it goes down, and then he puts on the other pair of shoes, and it goes up again, but it's still Adam Sandler. Like, that's, it's beautiful, and they have so much fun with that. But then the one that I will celebrate, and I honestly hope that they just did it in the most practical way possible, is when he goes into Jimmy's shop in disguise for the first time, and then he comes back into the cobbler shop, and he goes behind the curtain, and then you see the window behind it, and so he goes in as the Indian character, the Indian man, and then he comes back out, and it's Adam Sandler, and it's just like, that was gorgeous. It's just absolutely gorgeous. Like these moments that beautiful. The film is beautiful in just so many ways. And it's a shame that like there are such deficiencies or there is this Adam Sandler stink from just like his perception from the public at the time that have just infected this film and made it.
But I want to be fair to Sandler here. I think it's actually beyond that. I as much as that can be part of the stink, very often people cite this as a movie where he's trying, right? Like, so it is actually kind of recognized that he is doing some work here that is unexpected of him, right? I think the bigger thing is that this movie just has some issues beyond Sandler. And so what that does is Sandler comes in, you come into this movie expecting to not like Sandler, and then there's other stuff that's wrong, so you just write the whole thing off. Not for any moment reflecting on the fact that, but actually the Sandler part was not that bad, right? Like that kind of comes like after the fact. So in a lot of ways, it's not that Sandler, it's not like bringing Sandler to this movie kind of like it gets kind of stuck in that mud. It has its own issues, and Sandler gets stuck in its mud. And so I think that's where I've kind of am so disappointed in the movie is that Sandler does so much good work in it that the other issues of the film make me angry because Sandler is doing so much good work to not be doing a Sandler film and the film lets him down.
That's true. I mean, it is, and it's 7 years since he did Rain Over Me. So like based on the trajectories that we see with what he tries to do in his career, it's about time for him to do a film like this, for him to try to like stretch those acting muscles. And then again, seven more to like Uncut Gems. Like this fits in with that whole rotation of the types of film that he's doing, like kind of in a post Punch Drunk Love sort of career. I don't know. I mean, we haven't looked at that movie yet, so who knows what's going to happen once I finally watch that movie for the first time. But yeah, it is. I like this film. I like this film in so many ways. And
yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about some of the stuff.
Yeah, we are an hour in, so it is time for that tried and true Adam Sandler cinematic universe, like, centerpiece. Something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. Where we look at something that would be new to the ASCU if this film is included. Something old, something we've seen before. Something borrowed from the rest of Hollywood, right? To, like, I guess sort of kind of give it, I don't know. I like the borrowed part. It's what I enjoy. And then something blue, which Sijin and I will constantly debate till the end of days what that actually means. Now, I semi-spoiled my new. So we're going to let Sijin go first in that regard.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I've actually talked about his time with Dustin Hoffman before, but I think this is the first time we've actually seen it on screen. And I'd forgotten that they finally get a scene together at the end. I was pretty convinced that they didn't ever cross paths in this movie because of the fact of the nature of you know, him playing his father. I forgot that, like I said, the whole reveal at the end. So that was... So that was cool though, because one of my favorite later works of Sandler's that he does with Netflix, but I don't know if it actually fulfills any part of the contract he has with them or if it's just a good movie for him to be in, is he's in the Meyerowitz stories, in which him and Ben Stiller play brothers with Dustin Hoffman as their dad, if I'm remembering that movie correctly. Him getting to work with amazingly talented old school Hollywood guys is always kind of fun to watch. Like he has such a well-earned confidence, right? So like he's never afraid to be on camera with those guys. But this even goes as far back as something like, we haven't watched it yet, but Mixed Nuts, where he's on screen with Steve Martin in one of his earliest movies, right? Like and he holds his own in that movie. Like but there's this idea of being just watching him with these old Hollywood guys is always a blast, and the fact that Dustin Hoffman comes up not once but you know twice, I think. In fact, I be remiss if there was probably not a third one somewhere that I just like that I probably should know about, right? But this idea of seeing him with this with the older crowd actor is not new, but Dustin Hoffman sure is.
Yeah, and I will give you all credit for that. That was sort of when I'm glad I decided to stay away from it because I'm like pretty sure this is what Sijin's going to choose because it was nice to see him with Dustin Hoffman and all of these things that you've celebrated because Meyerowitz stories and Cobbler were two that I missed, but two that I knew Dustin Hoffman was in. So again, I was also like, oh, they're not going to get to interact. And then they do get to interact. And it is, I mean, you'll see just how much it means to me at the end. But yeah, this
is a good
it.
Moment.
Yeah. Imagine if Dustin Hoffman had been in Uncut Gems in any way, shape, or form.
Oh man.
Maybe in the new Safdie Brothers film. We'll see what happens.
I have later more and more as I age, Dustin Hoffman becomes a favorite of mine. And in fact, he always has kind of been. You know what movie I love that he's in that nobody ever really seems to jive with but me is I Heart Huckabees.
Why did I know that's what you were gonna say?
I love that movie, and he is so funny in it. It's him and it's
Lily
killing me
Tomlin.
Because I can't. It's Lily Tomlin as the other like agent. Like it's they're just fascinating and so funny in that movie. But anyway, Dustin Hoffman and seeing him on screen and them actually having a scene together at the end of this movie was all good stuff. And I just wanted to draw
and also,
attention to that.
I mean, like, I think about going to like the CDs. I think it's Stan and Judy's Kid that has Hot Water Burn Baby on it.
Yep.
It's either Stan or Judy's Kid or What the Hell Happened to Me. It's one of those two. And just like, that's Adam Sandler clearly being a fan of Rain Man and doing the character for an entire sketch.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's just one of those things that to then get to see that he got to work with somebody that he's clearly admired for some time. It's really enjoyable. Really, really enjoyable.
Yeah, and this isn't the last time I'm probably going to talk about Dustin Hoffman in this segment, so I don't want to use it all up.
Yeah, let's leave some on there. So I'm going to go with Tom McCarthy. Tom McCarthy, this is where Adam Sandler kind of hooks up with Tom McCarthy. And then again, we've already seen him in a film, and it was one of the like tentpole films of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. He's Michael the Robot in Pixels. That's Tom McCarthy in a classic Adam Sandler cameo moment. But then it's really interesting that we follow up Bedtime Stories with The Cobbler when you consider that Tom McCarthy did the story for Up, which is just another one of those let's be hyper depressing in the beginning of this movie type film, right?
Yeah, no, it's just, uh-huh.
Then
I mean, like Spotlight even has that kind of because of all the shit that has to go on in the first like
Spotlight's
hour
pretty much just
up.
Depressing up and down like, the line.
But then
he also wrote Million Dollar Arm, which was another Walt Disney film, and then he goes on after Spotlight 3 years later. Christopher Robin is by him. And then, as you pointed out,
sweet as hell.
Yeah, Timmy Failure.
Timmy Failure is also a very bittersweet film.
Yeah, like so, it's all this stuff, but it's one of those crazy things where, like, Adam Sandler clearly did not seem to enjoy his time working in collaboration with Walt Disney, based on Bedtime Stories and the fact that they have never connected again.
Yeah,
but he. It, that doesn't mean that anyone who's worked with Disney, he's going to hold up his nose at. Because this guy, at the time that they're doing The Cobbler, has written Up, which, you know, we all know what Up went on and did, and Million Dollar Arm, and he's still like, yeah, I'll do The Cobbler. I'll do this one. Like, you can direct me. You wrote this script. Let's do it. And that's very interesting in terms of it. And it has to have been a somewhat good experience, because then he does invite him to have a like classic Adam Sandler level cameo in Pixels as Michael the Robot.
Oh man. Awesome.
Yeah. Sorry. I gotta get my olds out. So I'm going to go with You Don't Mess with the Zohan. As my old here. And I know that like might seem like a bit of a cop out. We literally only talked about it two episodes ago. Bedtime Stories, Rain Over Me, and then You Don't Miss the Zohan. This movie follows so many of the same beats of Zohan. It's kind of crazy. It kind of feels like Adam Sandler definitely had an agenda between 2008 and 2015. And that agenda was, let's save New York City from gentrification.
Okay, so yeah, I will. So I think what it is it's the superhero-y nature of kind of movies picking up at that time, right? And like he's just kind of doing what he always did, and that's falling in love with film and making films that he wants to make. So he starts to follow that superhero formula, and I think the reason that they feel so similar is that they are both superhero movies, right? And the fact that they both take place in New York is just because like every superhero, like if you want to do a neighborhood superhero, you set it in a borough in New York somewhere, right?
I mean, thank you, Spider-Man, for establishing that.
But
But
I mean Daredevil, right? Like also has his bit there, and I mean I'm even thinking of things like Blank Man and stuff like that, where like you set them in just like a small city setting, small as opposed to the world, right? Like you don't make
well, I
them
mean,
save the
yeah.
universe.
It's well, I would think about like Meteor Man, which is
Meteor
another one
Man.
like totally set, and it's Harlem's first superhero
What's the
is the tagline
Bill
there.
Cosby one that he did? Didn't he have a superhero one too? Who cares?
Not that I know. I don't. Weird dude to bring into this conversation.
Ghost Dad? I don't know. What am I talking about?
Don't talk about Ghost Dad. It ruined Just Like Heaven for me. Or maybe the company did. But yeah, it feels so you don't mess with the Zohan with the fact that like halfway through we're given like this face to a person who kind of wants to comedically like just destroy the neighborhood to
Yeah.
make money. It's like to the
I
fact
think it's Joe's apartment, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean that's MTV. That's the nature of MTV. And what is Adam Sandler but MTV's golden child? You thought it was Puck from season two of The Real World. Surprise,
But this idea
surprise.
of like of the old neighborhood getting taken
Yeah.
over and then disappearing and all of this sort of stuff is definitely, fresh and old, right? Is something that we have openly talked about in public spaces for a while now, right? So like I think he's just reading the room really well.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it works. It clearly works. It's just really, if we hadn't just watched You Don't Mess with the Zohan, I don't think I would have made the connection quite as strongly as I did. But yeah, it just feels so much like You Don't Mess with the Zohan in so many weird ways in
Yeah,
terms
no,
of, yeah. So that's my gonna be my old. What do you got for old?
I mean, we have to talk about Steve Buscemi, right? And I think specifically in the regards that as the old buddy that is showing up, he's the only old buddy that shows up, from what I can tell. Like
So,
I've looked up and down, and I can maybe find one or two people. We point at, as you pointed out, Tom McCarthy ends up becoming somebody that he brings back in later films, but like other than that, Steve Buscemi's kind of it, yeah.
I went up and down trying to figure stuff. Jackie Sandler doesn't show up, but her brother Chris T-Tone does. He is the
Okay.
detective in Chicago. Chicago.
Chicago.
Duck Chicago.
Come on down to Camp Chicago.
He's the detective who arrests Brian when
Okay.
Mr. Solomon arrives in Chicago. It's Jackie Sandler's brother, and he's been in a bunch of films, like Grown Ups 2, and he's always had like those little roles. It's just that he's not as iconic as Jackie Sandler because like they're married and she took his name, but he's her brother, and it's nice to see him show up. Jared Sandler, his nephew, shows up in the bar scene. He's one of the guys at the bar. And that was kind of nice too, because Jared Sandler has been one of those like stealth cameos that I have started noticing after being like, who the fuck's this guy in Pixels?
Right.
But then the one that I almost said for my old, but then I couldn't get over the Zohan connection to this film. And it really just being like 6 years between the two films, and that's kind of the same type of movie that he's doing. But Stuart Rudin, who is the second person that we see Max transforms into, it's the older gentleman with the gray and white beard.
Okay,
He is the bus stop bum in Little Nicky.
Nice.
And I love a Little Nicky connection. It's just it's kind of hard not to just point at it. But yes, of the like brand name, if there was an Adam Sandler's crew action figure line, like characters who would be featured in it, Steve Buscemi is the only one. And you know what? Even saying that, Steve Buscemi would probably wind up being a store exclusive. He wouldn't be in the like main wave. You'd have to go to like Target to get the Steve Buscemi figure. Which is sad because, you know, I love Steve Buscemi and I love that
it would definitely have to be Billy Madison Buscemi with the rifle, right? Like with the blue, blue short sleeve button down and the rifle.
And the bright red lipstick. That's why it's a Target exclusive.
Yeah.
Oh man. Sorry. That toy stuff. I got a little side project I'm working on to maybe celebrate some of my toy stuff, but that's more of a Stay Report story. But yeah, it is. Steve Buscemi is a really good pull, especially when everybody was losing their mind about how did he get Steve Buscemi to be in Hubie Halloween. The real question is, how did he get Steve Buscemi to be in The Cobbler?
I mean, I really like that they got to do some really good like scenes together, some really good moments together. Like the one where after the funeral, when Buscemi Jimmy
outside reveals in the snow.
When he reveals the whole thing about how your dad got into a lot of trouble and had to go into hiding, like that whole moment where they like fight on the car and stuff, like that was some really intense like moments that we never get to see from the two of them together. So it was really cool to get to see not just him bringing in one of his old friends to work, but to like do a different kind of movie with them. You know, it was wild.
I mean, really, it makes sense that of all the people, and this is not to slag off anybody else in the Adam Sandler crew, but like, if Adam Sandler, as critics have posited, was trying to gain some cachet in Hollywood by working with this well-known writer-director in Tom McCarthy, the person that you would bring to that is the guy who's been with the Coen brothers for almost every film, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's
yeah,
the one...
I mean, you know, I don't... Yeah, it's... I totally get what you're saying. I also want to say that I don't think, with all of the fun that people seem to have working on Sandler films time and time again, he does not strike me as the kind of guy that uses his friends like baseball cards, right, when he's making these kinds of deals.
No, I agree. I don't think that's it at all. I think it's one of those situations where he's like, if we can get Buscemi for this role, would you be all right with that, Tom?
Yeah.
Like, if I can get him to read for it. I agree. I don't think he uses them like baseball cards, but if you're looking at the script for The Cobbler and you're like, and you're Adam Sandler, are like, who of the people that I like to work with would I recommend to the director to like reach out to and see if we can get in this film? It feels like Buscemi would be at the top of the list based upon the screenplay. Yeah. Does that make sense? Sure. I mean, I'm sad that Kevin James isn't in it. It would have been so funny if he put on a pair of shoes and was Kevin James suddenly.
Even for just a shot, right?
Yeah.
Like just a moment of him just becoming Kevin James would have been good for the joke.
And that will... Once we get to the time where we decide, is this or isn't this in the ASCU, that's going to be a kind of a big crux of my argument.
Yeah. And I mean, like, to that point, I didn't really mention in the Facts and Figures earlier, and I should have, is that, like, this also does not come across as a Happy Madison movie, right? Like, there's never a moment where it's called a Happy Madison production.
Well, it's not a Happy Madison film at all, which is, I think...
That's what I'm saying, is, like, it we never see any indication that he's involved in any way other than as this, like, as an actor.
He's,
you know, obviously there's some... Obviously, there's some cachet behind him being in this movie. I mean, obviously, he got something for being in this movie because, as you pointed out, it didn't seem to have a budget a bunch more than, you know, maybe $10 million, like, at the most. And, like, was that all spent on just Sandler? or does he have some other, like, you know, stock in this film and it just doesn't pan out, right?
Yeah. And we may never know because, as the producers taught us, films like this, they don't really do the forensic accounting that they should.
Why would they care? It's a flop.
Exactly. All right. So yeah. I guess just one more old. Well, it's two more olds, and they're both related to food, and they're like bonus olds, right? Enjoy the bonus old.
Couple of bonus olds for you.
In Max's refrigerator, while he is waiting for Leon Ludlow to show up and pick up his shoes, there is a bottle of Yoo-hoo, which is believed to be there as a reference to Big Daddy and the whole. Yoo-hoo's good, but no, it's not good. Yoo-hoo with some rum in it. Which might only be because like, we just watched Big Daddy as also part of the season four for the fans. And then the other one is the fact that while he is following Leon Ludlow to like learn about him, he decides to stop at a street basketball game and eat a Subway sandwich. And then also just in
the makings of a beautiful marriage.
In bucking the trend of an Adam Sandler film, Max Simkin almost exclusively drinks Coca-Cola and not Pepsi, which is very strange.
Okay.
Sorry, right. I'm having some fun with this one. Which brings us to Borrowed, and we have been talking about it and talking around it for a while, and that is the fact that the end of this movie is just Kingsman the Secret Service, right?
Yeah, essentially. He joins this like long-standing order of guards of the neighborhood where he gets to now become a different people and save the world. Yeah, it's wild. I mean, like, it basically, this is a superhero origin film, and the last bits of this film like really set up like a franchise, a hell of a franchise.
It feels more like celebrating its 8th anniversary today, the day that we're recording it, Big Hero 6, and the whole moment at the end with Fred and his father is revealed to be Stan Lee, and right. Like there's a long standing line of heroes, Fred. It feels.
To be fair, that's a post credit scene. I just want, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. I feel the only mistake that I see in the Cobbler is that credits do not roll after the car crash. Patrick the Rat Prick comes, grabs him while he's dressed up as Leon Ludlow, giving Leon's ex-girlfriend the watches and being like, go make a life for yourself because I was bad to you. And that car is hit by a truck, and that is when credits should roll. And then the credits roll, and if you were like big enough to stay and watch through the credits, then you are rewarded with the superhero origin Nick Fury style scene of Steve Buscemi being revealed to be Dustin Hoffman, and it like how it's going to connect to a grander superhero universe. If that were all,
the Taylor Initiative.
If that were all the Tradesman Initiative is what it would be called. Let's just be honest.
Oh, because then you could get in like the plumber, right? Just, like,
well, I mean, that's the whole thing. They say like, don't trust dry cleaners. They have too much power. Like it is like Tradesmen is essentially what they are. Tradesmen have magic powers in the universe of the Cobbler. Like the tinsmith and everything. Like,
I'm starting to think if the question is not, is this in this Adam Sandler cinematic universe, but is this in the Marvel cinematic universe?
No, because it's not Nick Fury. If frickin' Jimmy took off his shoes and it were goddamn Samuel L. Jackson, we need to talk about something.
Max. Secret Invasion 2. This time it's shoes.
It's the screw. I tried to do shoes and Skrulls together, and I couldn't do it. The shoes!
No.
Yeah,
no,
shul
no,
doesn't
no.
work in the Cobbler
no, no.
with its heavy Hebrew implications. It's Kingsman. It's Big Hero 6. It is, and it almost feels like a parody and satirical jab at all of those.
For no reason, because the rest of the movie doesn't feel like that.
Yeah,
it's wild.
It is. But that is my Borrowed, because that is what is going on in Hollywood at this time.
So my Borrowed for this comes from a lot of the critiques of this film, where they talk about the idea that it's Sandler doing what they deem. I'm not taking this word as my own, because we'll talk about it. But they call it old comedy. There's a lot of people that are talking about Sandler visiting like old comedy or the old comedy well and they compare it to some actors that do a lot more physical shtick and things like that. But as we pointed out, Sandler is not really the one doing a lot of the physical shtick in this movie, because it is generally when it is a different person it is the character that is doing the physical shtick, but it's not Sandler that's doing it. There's some moments, I guess, but not really for him. And so with that in mind, right, I was trying to figure out what kind of movies they were talking about, and it really is the walk a mile in their shoes, like change up style film, right? Like it is the body switch comedy, right? It is that whole idea. And I was thinking of, but it's always with that point of like, you become this other person for long enough that you learn something, and that's what we're told this movie is supposed to be. I don't know if it succeeds, as we've talked about. But like the one movie that I keep thinking of is like Down to Earth, right? But the other one that does it, and it's not a full body switch, but it is very much this idea of like stepping into another person's shoes that I think it actually borrows a lot from, is Tootsie, just to bring the Dustin Hoffman of it all together.
Loving it. That is absolutely wonderful. Imagine if that's how Tootsie became Tootsie.
But that whole idea of like of experiencing life on the other side, and it's supposed to teach you these lessons and make you a better person, right? And that is definitely something that they are diving into. But I mean, it even goes so far as like looking at some older films, like what's the one, Jimmy Stewart there, the Christmas one.
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life, where it's looking at the world without him in it. So it's not even like a switch up, a body switch up, but like almost like just like, what if your body wasn't there, right? And there's a lot of that kind of implication too in some of this stuff, where he feels like he's just kind of this like nobody in the neighborhood, and he only really finds himself a life through other people's lives by the end of this. It's a very sad concept, like when you really think about it.
Yeah, but he also gets Melanie Diaz, and I love Melanie Diaz. Hamlet 2, Be Kind, Rewind. It's so great that she is in this film, especially after like the last film she did before The Cobbler. I mean, released. The last film released before The Cobbler releases is Fruitvale Station, where she
Oh
is
man.
fantastic. I mean, that movie's just fucking exceptional up and down, but it was really great to see Melanie Diaz again. And sort of in that same space where I fell in love with her as an actor to begin with, something like Hamlet 2, where they're like trying to revitalize the theater program, or Be Kind, Rewind, where they're trying to save the block from getting destroyed. Like, it was great to see her as the head of the Lower East Side Action Committee, 'cause I like it just feels like that's where she's always been.
No, she was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you tapped into it, but the reason why I was going to say you were thinking of the change up is the whole body swap of everything. And then I was going to go one step further with Ellen Barkin, who is the third billed person in this film and does not appear until 59 minutes and 58 seconds preparing duck ragu. She was in The Switch, which is one of those body swap movies, and actually, like, kind of my favorite body swap movie. I like Vice Versa. I like Freaky Friday and all of those. But The Switch is cool because, like, there's no switching back, right? The
Right.
womanizer dies and then is sent back to Earth as an attractive female, and to like learn why he shouldn't have objectified women and just
Right,
how it
right.
made people feel. And then, like, to actually have somebody who was in that style of body swap comedy in this film as the villain too, that was a really cool thing to me. And I'm just a huge fan of
Yeah,
Ellen Barkin too.
and I think that that's where a lot of my like squishiness with a lot of the morality and the ethics of this movie really start to kind of get kind of into it. Maybe we should just move into Blue after
We're
you got to do
moving
your
into
borrowed.
Blue, and you can go first. That was going to be my final. That was my bonus borrowed.
Yeah, well, so the Blue of this whole thing is, this movie likes to get real kind of close to gross, right? And so it's not that there is actual sexual assault in this movie, but like there's a scene where he gets very close to committing some really problematic acts, like a la like Revenge of the Nerds style, like just because it's kind of, yeah.
I'm
So
sorry, I
like
had to say you there because it's Aneek from Letterkenny who ends up playing Taryn, and I'm like, I know this actor. What do I know her from? And then like
yeah.
to go on and be like, oh, it's Aneek, and I had to do you every time she was on screen. But then there's that real you moment where he walks in Dan Stevens' body, which also Dan
Right.
Stevens is in this film at a
Yeah.
moment where Dan Stevens is having a moment. He was just Lancelot in Attack of the Museum, Attack of the Museum,
Yeah,
Night at
right.
the
Night at the
Museum
museum.
3, And he was just everywhere. So the fact that he shows up as Emiliano in this film is fantastic. And then, you know, I can't think of her name and I feel awful. Taryn is the character's name. I think it's Conover, maybe like that. Do I still have it open?
Kim Cloutier?
Yeah, Kim Cloutier. And like, now she is iconic to me as Anique from Letterkenny and then later on Shoresy. So it was like really fun to see her in one of these films. I mean, that's what I'm really liking about going back to this Adam Sandler stuff is like seeing these actors that I know from other stuff now and how they got to work with Adam Sandler before. Like, that's super
well,
cool.
Well, not in this scene. Keep in mind, Adam Sandler's not in
that's
this
true.
Scene.
He's not in that scene. But like that moment of, yeah, I'm going to just sleep with her. I'm not even going to think about it. And then he looks down at his shoes and realizes nobody keeps their shoes on during sex. I mean, is that worse or better than having your socks on? Like, let's just coupling it right
but
now.
The idea being, right, what? But the idea being that that's like the only thing that really gives him pause at that moment. And then like he seems to kind of get to the idea of how gross it would be and then leaves. But like, it's just, it plays this card again with the mother stuff. Like, I'm glad that you could turn off that part of your brain that was not like, what the fuck is going on here? Because that was not the case for me or many people that watch this movie, where like, it gets so close to like, gross. Like, what is going to happen here? What is the implications? What is going on? What are we moving forward with? And then it never goes there. So like, it weirdly, it's not that there's moments in this movie that are upsetting and problematic, but this movie like dances so close to that so many times. And then like, almost as if to prove that it is above that, that it is not going to do that, it's showing you what it could do and then being like, but we're not going to do that. It's like, you didn't have to go there. Like, you just didn't have to. Like, why could it not have just been like a phone call for his mother or something? Like, it was just, it's just really weird the ways in which it gets really close. But at the end of the day, it made me realize that I was like thankful that it didn't get gross in all of those moments. I wasn't really thinking about the fact that like, it doesn't change the fact that he is portraying other people, like willingly going into other bodies and doing other lives. And the reason that I was kind of relating this to what we were talking about with the body swap stuff is the other person is usually aware, right? In those, and that kind of alleviates a little bit. It is always a concern about how do we fix it, right? Like, they're always working to correct it. In this, those people aren't given that choice, right? Like, their bodies are being taken over unexpectedly. I wrote down I wrote down my only real like joke for this entire thing was Super Sandler's Odyssey. Like, the ways in which he just like Cappy style takes over people's like fucking bodies and lives. And like, the ethical implications of Super Mario Odyssey have been explored. People have asked a lot of important questions about like, where's the line on this, and like, and how can we like be okay with the fact that he is like willingly taking over people's bodies and in some cases destroying those bodies, right? And that kind of becomes this whole thing in the cobbler of just like, he is kind of doing this really gross thing. Whereas I was thinking, like, one of my favorite versions of this, despite all the other problematic shit in this movie, I understand, but is Big, right? Where like, he's not taking over somebody else's body. He's just, it is an older version of his own body. That's not a body that existed for somebody else before. So the things that he does to that body are not as offensive to me, right? As it is if it is somebody taking over somebody else's and then their body's being used unwillingly in ways that they're not able to consent to, right? Like, it just becomes really weird. So as far as the blue of this movie for me, it's just kind of the whole premise kind of just has this veneer of just like ick to it.
Yeah. So I will say, since you brought up Super Mario Odyssey, in that he is actually taking over the body, in the cobbler, he is becoming a double of that person.
Yeah, that's true.
But that does not change the fact, the person that I feel the worst for...
Anybody talking to him, right?
Well, on some level, no. Wayne Wilderson plays young preppy man, and that is the person that he goes to a clearly 5-star style restaurant and orders a huge meal and then walks out on the check. Like, that guy is still alive by all accounts, right?
Right.
Because
he is not
decaying in any way, shape, or form. And he was able to get served at that restaurant. If he smelled like death, which they imply so many times from the dead bodies that he eventually portrays, like, that guy, I'm sure that they have cameras, and what's to stop them from going and arresting that guy for like dining and dashing on what was clearly a multi-hundreds of dollars bill?
I mean, how fucked up is that woman going to be when her actual boyfriend comes home at some point and she's like, "It was great to see you this afternoon, but you ran away. What happened?"
Yeah,
And they
why
now
did
have to have that
yeah.
conversation of him being like, "I didn't come home," and her being like, "What the fuck was that then?" Right? Like he's completely fucked up those people.
I mean, they're still together in the end, so I will say that. But also, we brush that away with the fact that Dan Stevens is secretly a homosexual, which is also not the best look that
Oh yeah, no.
apparently,
Oh, I didn't
like.
even get into the ways in which the cross-dressing trans, it's never really quite made clear what they identify as in this film. Like this person in this film that is in the, somewhere on that scale, and they just are real happy to introduce this character and use them in really upsetting ways. So like there is some straight up shitty humor in this movie as well. But I think the problem is that like that's just like peaks. And this movie never comes clean for me. Like so I think it's more important to me to state that the whole movie has this kind of blue comedy feel to it, blue drama, whatever it is, like this entire fucking time. And it just never, I never got comfortable watching this movie for a
Yeah,
lot of reasons.
and I completely understand that. But the moments where like he is pretending to be someone else to commit crime, like he steals Joey Slotnick's shoes. First of all, love Joey Slotnick. Big shout out, high five. I loved you in The Single Guy when you were married to Ming-Na Wen. Love that stuff. And I love to see him in this movie as Slick Guy. But when he goes up to him as Leon, at that point, we don't know that Leon is a bad dude. Right? We don't. There's still part of me that thought that the movie was going to wind up being an unlikely friendship between the two of
Oh,
them.
can you imagine if they had portrayed like Leon having a shit life? So this whole lesson that he learns is, oh, this guy was an asshole to me, but he's also having things in his own life. I
Yeah.
should learn to understand that. No, what they do is they portray this guy as an asshole to me, and I've gone and confirmed he is an asshole, so now I'm gonna bring this motherfucker down. It becomes this like weird like revenge
Yeah,
story.
it's just. Because that moment, though, but that moment, he doesn't know any of that when he confronts Joey Slotnick and he's like, "What size are your shoes? Give them to me." So that he can steal his car. Like, there's also so many, like, morally, not even gray, but, like, black moments where he just breaks the law as other people. And then, of course, he's not going to have to suffer those consequences, but somebody is going to have to suffer those consequences.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and so this is kind of where it goes back to that stuff we were talking about before, where if it was more of a fable, more of a folklore story, you wouldn't really care about this stuff because these people only exist for that moment and then they disappear into dust. They're not real people, right? But this movie wants you to believe so badly that this is happening in the real world with all of these real things and these real repercussions here and there that you then can't help but think about the other repercussions throughout, right? Because like it does, this is one of those moments where it fails as kind of as folklore for me because it's just too real. It's too grounded.
Yeah, I get it. I still really loved this film, and it's I don't
I
know
know
what
you
about it. I
feel
don't
you need to
like
keep saying that.
I
And I want you to know, we all understand and we all support your love of this film. We have to be fair about what happened on screen for both of us.
Oh yeah, no. I will admit all of these thoughts are definitely thoughts that I had. Sorry, I had to get my Adam Sandler blanket off of the back of my chair because I want to
To hold
see.
it and cry while I rip your movie
No,
apart,
I
I'm
want to see
sorry.
if the cobbler is on here. Because, like, that would be bananas. Like, there's
Yes.
already some weird movies on here. It is not. Thank God the cobbler is not on this blanket. I mean, I looked at the smaller one. I have a bigger one, too. I have two Adam Sandler blankets. There's your reveal in the middle of the 25th episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Take that one to the bank. Someday at a bar trivia, that'll be the question, and the answer
Devin,
will be two.
you've been putting it off for too long. You need to admit to us now what you chose as your blue for this movie.
Oh, is the blue Converse All-Star gym bag that he
Nice.
keeps his magical shoes in?
That he
It
carries his
was
fucking superhero
that's
powers
his
in.
superhero thing. I mean, the whole uniform too. The fact that he uses Albert's overcoat and like so that's how you recognize that it's him and all of the different bodies
With
is
the
beautiful.
scarf, right?
With the
Yeah.
scarf, yeah. I mean, the scarf is there from the beginning, but then it is specifically the overcoat that is weirdly dropped off to him right in the beginning of the movie. And I will point out, because we do the little scenes at the beginning of the episodes, right? The script, as I was searching for the script before I decided I'm just going to transcribe from the scenes, all of it starts in the shop, which leads me to believe that the whole Gergerman stuff in 1903 was added later.
Yeah, like reshoots. Like we need to give more grounding to this. But we can't get Adam Sandler or any of the other actors back. Okay, well then let's write this tacked on. That actually makes a lot. Well, it doesn't make the movie make sense, but it makes my confusion and why it feels like that scene comes from nowhere and doesn't fit. That clarifies that actually.
Yeah, it's really strange because all of it started with, here are my Albert shoes, you should sell them, and there's an overcoat in there for you. That's the first line of every version of the script that is available online, and I'm like...
That's actually amazing, like, because I'm really, really, really digging this idea of viewing it as a superhero film, of it being about him getting these powers and all of this, right, and him using it, learning to use them responsibly and all of this stuff, right? Like, viewing it from that angle has become all the more interesting to me, and if that is the case, if that is where this movie traditionally start, like originally was written to start, that makes it make sense. That makes that all the more important. That's beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Granted, there's scripts online, right? It's not like I was able to find one of the actual scripts that was used on set. I would love that. And now I kind of want to search for it. Well,
be careful with that shit,
man.
Did I ever tell you what happened when I ordered a Knives Out script for myself for Christmas last year? Like, I was, you know, ordering a bunch of books and shit off of Amazon, and I was getting all this free shipping left and right. And one time I had to hit a quota, so I was like, I'll buy myself something. And I was like, oh, the Knives Out script, perfect. It showed up, and it was definitely one of those, like, binded at home style, like, laminated each page. Like, I was like, this is not an authorized script in any way. I went back and looked online, and that was not what it looked like in the pictures. But I was like, I still got the script, and as far as I could tell, it's right, so fuck it.
Yeah, it's I have a Mallrats like that, but I got it signed by Kevin Smith. But this is more Say Report topic stuff. We should try to get back to the Cobbler, which we've hit the runtime. We've done our old borrowed new blue. Is there anything else you feel we need to discuss before we weigh in on whether or not this is part of our ASCUC, Jim?
No, we actually did hit the few notes that I had. We have hit them all. All
right. Same. which brings me to the fact that inside of me right now, there are two wolves.
Yes, as often we discuss, yes. What are these two wolves feasting on today?
One of the wolves believes that everything in this film... And all of the ways that magic exists and the fact that it is so segmented off and it is so different and it is so trying to establish its own cinematic universe means that there's no possible way that it could also exist within the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. Like, it's just too different on so many levels that it doesn't fit. But then the other wolf is the wolf that says, or... this is the crux. This is the keystone, the Rosetta Stone to explaining how the Adam Sandler cinematic universe could actually work and function. Because every Adam Sandler character is just Max Simkin in another pair of shoes. But because we are the viewer, much like Quantum Leap, we see Max Simkin in that role.
I mean, it ticks a lot of boxes for me for being in it. Like, he learns a lesson by the end of it. He becomes a more mature person. There's a strong female love interest that does not really need him.
Yeah.
Right, like, she's not...
She is the strongest love interest.
She's not defined by him, right?
Definitely magic does not need him at all.
Yeah, magic is definitely real. Family is an important factor to the story. I honestly don't have any reason to say it's not.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, like, it really does feel like not only that, but any squickiness about any of the other films that we've questioned can kind of be waved away if this exists in it. Because it could just be another magic pair of shoes.
I mean, right. At this point, like, heaven is real, hell is real, and the shoes are magic. Like, there's
Mama
no.
Mama says they
no
is my
loss.
Magic shoes.
Mm-hmm. This explains how Hubie's mom gets away at the end of Hubie Halloween.
Oh my god, Hubie's mom was just Steve Buscemi in a pair of shoes!
The entire time.
Oh,
shit.
Oh man. I mean, it was Kathy Bates' character from Waterboy in a pair of June Squibb shoes. It's just like, it breaks so much, but yeah, I guess I would be all right putting it in the universe, especially.
Like I said, I think it fits. So, like, if that's where you're at, I think we have our answer.
I think that that wolf is the wolf that we're feeding. So, welcome to the ASCU. Remember, with great shoes comes great responsibility. He murders a guy. This film escalates so quickly in this one moment.
I know. It's crazy.
Oh, man. With great... I have to write down, with great shoes comes great responsibility.
Hold on. That's one for the bathroom reader.
Yes. No, it's. I mean, it's in the synopsis. It's.
I'll send that off to Farmer's Almanac. Thank you.
No, I really liked this film, and it works. It really does. Like, if you distill it down, the fact that I could compare it to so many other films that we have looked at just in this season, let alone across the 24 other episodes that we've done of this show, it checks a lot of the boxes that movies that we haven't included just ignored altogether.
Yeah, no, and as I've always stated, my enjoyment of a film was never going to be the thing that dictated whether or not it was part of this. We always wanted to play by the rules. And with that in mind, I have to detach myself from all of my feelings about this and look at the rules. And the rules state pretty clearly that this fits in. So,
meanwhile, I'm over here saying, I love this film so much. Do I want it to cross-pollinate with the other films? But no, I do, because it does. It's already, there's so much there. And what's really important about it, what I really like for it, I don't know if it's full-on law-making. I don't know if it's worth getting out the chisel and hammer to add to the stone tablets of our ASCU. But
we could write it on some parchment and nail it to the church door for everybody.
Oh, I love it. We need 98 other things, though. Otherwise, no one will take it seriously. Sorry.
Okay, they don't know anyway.
Wow, that's a deep comment that you just made there, Martin. let's wait till Martin comes. Is the fact that it also means that when Adam Sandler isn't the creative force behind a film, right? Whether it's with like Steve Brill or Tim Herlihy or Dennis Dugan, people that he's worked with who he understands their sensibilities and is also able to like weigh in, add, and change the story. It seems like there is a specific type of story in film that Adam Sandler is receptive to being a part of. Mm-hmm. That's what this film proves, because this film is the furthest thing from being a Happy Madison production. And yet in so many of the beats and moments, it feels that way. But I don't feel with something like Billy Madison, where it is said that because Adam Sandler was playing that role, so much of the film got changed to fit him being there and with his comedic sensibilities. This film feels like it is still all Tom McCarthy, and it is just Adam living in his world and creating a character to exist in his world for him. Something like Reign Over Me. Like, it feels like he is there to act. He is there as a soldier, not as a general.
Yeah. But, and that's why I say that it's very easy, like, to take the swing and lay blame at the feet of Sandler for this movie not working. But I think really the movie is not doing itself any favors. And I think Sandler is just doing what he can, and it's just not enough to pull this movie out of whatever valley it falls into for a lot of people. I totally agree that Sandler, it's one of those rare ones where Sandler is kind of on display, like, as an actor and not much else, but still seems to bring so much of himself to this movie. I mean, and you know, he's the titular character, as it should be. You know, it's not like he's stealing the movie from somebody else, you know.
He's also the titular actor because apparently Sandler is Hebrew for cobbler, which is my favorite bit of trivia that is just everywhere. About this movie.
That's true. I'd have to look into that. That's an interesting fact.
I don't know. I found it in three different places, which doesn't mean that it's substantiated. It just means
they're
all
referencing one another, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Based on these two other sources, it has to be true. Well, one of those sources is using you as a source. You know what? Sandler means cobbler in Hebrew. Just accept it. All right.
If that's true, that's really nifty.
One of them actually says the literal translation. And I don't know. It's out there if you want to look into it. I don't know if it's true or not. I just thought it was an interesting bit of... Imagine if that's why he took the role. Oh, the cobbler. That's my last name in Hebrew. Who knows? All right. So we are here at the end of another episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Thank you so much for joining us on this adventure. It's at this point that we usually share the next episode, what we're going to be focusing on and exploring. And this is not going to buck from the norm.
You set that up, right? Like we were going to suddenly change up everything.
I wanted to walk a mile in the shoes of a show that would do something like that. I didn't like it. I didn't care for it at all. So what we're doing to wrap up season four, our season for the fans, that's you. We are covering a film that everybody asked, well, why didn't you do this film as your December movie? And I just kind of looked at them dumb, like, because Eight Crazy Nights exists. That's a film that is out there. That's the one you do in your first, like, year of Adam Sandler exploration. But this film is still important, and it is one that has been asked for since the beginning, and that is Mixed Nuts. So join us here in December. I actually think it drops on December 9th, right? Is that right? Let me look at the calendar. I don't know why I'm asking you.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I would know. I can't tell you what day today is. Never mind what day that will be.
It's the 9th. It's 11/9. Never forget. I can't believe I just said that. I'm so sorry. Moving to next month. Yeah. So that episode will be dropping on December 9th, and it will be our Mixed Nuts episode in order to celebrate the season. So make sure you're here for that. And if you have any questions or things that you want us to do, this is still a season for the fans, and that was chosen because of the fans. But make sure you get us. We're on Twitter at the ASCU, or you can always send us an email directly to AdamSandlerCinematicUniverse@gmail.com if there's something that you want us to cover. And also remember, just because you might have suggested a movie and we haven't covered it in season four for the fans, that doesn't mean that we're not listening. But one specific movie that we have heard a lot of people ask for, I can promise you that it's going to be part of what we have planned in season five. So, excellent. Yeah, so that's going to be exciting. We're going to go to town, right? Maybe you get it. I don't know. If you've enjoyed what we've done here at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, this comes out every month, but you can also find CJ and I weekly at our other podcast, which is about everything, not just one hyper-specific topic. So that's the Say Report, and new episodes of that are dropping every Monday, and it is available wherever podcasts are found. If you would like to talk to CJ about Christmas movies in particular, because we are dropping this at sort of the start of the Christmas season, you can find him on Twitter at Siege versus the World. You're still on Twitter, right? I probably should have checked that first. I don't know how the whole
we're gonna
Elon
have to discuss that soon. At the moment, I am, but you know, times they are a changing. But we'll talk about that soon.
That's a more of a Say Report topic. You're right.
In the meantime, if you have any idea whose shoes you'd like to walk a mile in and you want to throw those ones to Devin, you can catch him at Devin D. Decker.
Right. I would love to hear about it. And I can elaborate further about what it was like for me to walk a mile in another pair of my shoes. Shoes that had never before today ever left the house. I am an odd character, Sijin. But until next time, again, thank you so much for coming with us on this journey. And just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe @gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.
You gotta be kidding me.
As my father's shoes worked for me, mine will work for you.
Who are all these people?
Customers. They help us to help others. They're all labeled.
Derek Jeter?
That one was for me.
Pop, you made all these shoes?
Oh, no. No, no, no. These shoes go all the way back to your great-grandfather Pincus. He passed them on to my father Herschel, just as I'm passing it on to you. It's a privilege to walk in another man's shoes, Max, but it's also a responsibility. I think you've learned that by now. You are a guardian of souls, Max. You are the cobbler. That is your thing.